Tonight on Arena, bringing the story of Joe Exotic and Carol Baskin of Tiger King to the operatic stage. And where do I start with Akira Kurosawa? +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Remember back before we went into full lockdown, all anyone wanted to talk about were two private zoo owners, Joe Exotic and Carol Baskin, the two sworn enemies of the documentary series Tiger King. Now, as part of the Carlow Arts Festival, you can see an opera based on Tiger King. It's called Exotic v. Baskin, the Micro Opera. Carlow Arts Festival has gone online and you can see the opera live streamed on this coming Saturday evening. And joining me now is the writer of the libretto for Exotic v. Baskin, Tom Swift. A micro opera is what we're dealing with here. You've given us the book, the libretto here, Tom, and the composer, Dana Kaufman, who is US-based, has given us the music. But you actually met her through a librettist site on Facebook. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was one an interesting meeting of minds, because I was a member of a librettist Facebook group, which is a pretty niche activity. I hadn't really logged onto it very often. I just happened to see one day Dana posted she was looking for somebody to write the libretto for an opera based on a pop culture figure. And I was kind of intrigued by that, so got in touch. And then she told me it was to be about the Kardashians. And my heart kind of sank at that point. But we actually ended up writing a full opera Kardashian, which has had a couple of, you know, small scale concert performances. And eventually, hopefully, we'll be able to put on a full scale version of it.
Why did your heart sink when she said, when she mentioned the Kardashians to you? I would have thought they, no less so than Joe Exotic and Carol Baskin, are perfect operatic material, given the over the top nature of some of the activities.
Yeah, probably lack of familiarity with the subject matter. I hadn't really watched the programme a lot, but when I did get into it and when I did watch the programme, I really kind of, you discover the themes and the characters and you begin to weave a story and a narrative. And what came out of that was very much about the sort of the twin track between Caitlyn Jenner and her transition from presenting as male to her true identity, and Kim Kardashian's kind of journey, if you like, from being on top of the world to her being kind of caught in her Paris hotel room and being robbed and tied up. We just thought those were two really interesting tracks. So that was the sort of the core of Opera Kardashian, but with a lot of fun and a lot of satire and not taking them too seriously, because honestly, yeah, they shouldn't be.
Yeah. What about Tiger King then? Had you been enthralled by the Netflix documentary series like so many people?
Absolutely. It's a brilliant documentary. It's a brilliant series, and it's brilliantly as a piece of storytelling. You know, they had amazing material and they made the most of it. I loved the way that there was just you know, a cliffhanger at the end of every episode. So yeah, it was absolutely binge worthy and had everything that, you know, you'd want from an opera. It had jealousy, violence, you know, love, hate. Yeah. And big cats. So it just really, when Dana was the one who got in touch and said, listen, any chance you'd be interested in take, we've done the Kardashians, do you want to go have a go at Tiger King? You know, there's only one answer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you sum up Tiger King. You know, madman, or certainly dubiously seeing man has big cats in a private zoo, and woman who may or may not have been involved in the death of her husband, according to Joe Exotic, yes, but according to her, no, is then battling him against, as she sees it, his maltreatment of these exotic animals. Makes it sound a little bit boring. It's far from it, isn't it?
It's far from it. And actually, just seeing on the news today that Carol has managed to take possession of the zoo. So for anyone who's seen the show, that's huge news. But yeah, I mean, there's so many twists and turns and so many, you know, additional characters like Doc Antle, who's this other zoo owner who rides around on a huge elephant and has this kind of harem of young women who look after his cats. It's quite extraordinary. Every time you think it can't get more bizarre and more extreme, it does. So it's definitely, we've a load of material. The only problem, I guess, for us as opera makers was trying to distill it down, and we were commissioned by Carlo to produce a micro opera, 4 minutes. It's just coming in at just over four minutes. And, you know, how do you distill all the madness into one short piece? But I guess we kind of looked at it as, well, let's give this a shot. We basically had 4 weeks to turn this around from our very first meeting to talk about this between myself and Dana and Ariana and Lucia. To actually delivering it, so it's been an interesting journey, and it's, you know, it's great to have a deadline. So I suppose that's what's spurred us on, and a lot of us have more time in our hands than we would have ordinarily. Yeah.
Well, in fact, I suppose music can say so much more. It can say so much more in a very small amount of time. You know, just the nature of the sound that we're hearing tells a big part of the kind of madness of this story. I think if we listen to a clip, we'll get a sense of this. Exotic v. Baskin. The exotic here is Joe. Baskin is Carl. So this first clip is from Joe's side.
Carol Baskin. Somebody thinks they're gonna walk in here and take my animals away. Animals away. Before you bring me down, it is my belief that you will stop breathing.
It's just extraordinary. And the impersonation of Joe Exotic there at the end, it's Lucia Lucas with a baritone voice who's playing the part of Joe in this production, this micro operatic production of Tiger King that Tom Swift is telling us about this evening. Maybe you just explain Lucia's story, because in fact that fed into the Kardashian story that you were talking about earlier on.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I mean, Lucia is, a world-renowned baritone, born as male but identifying as female. And, you know, over the last 10 years or so, she has transitioned, but still retains a really world-class baritone voice, and has appeared on and still performs as male despite having transitioned. So she's actually about 2 years ago, I think she sang at the National Concert Hall. She's played lead roles in big houses like Tulsa Opera in the States, and I understand she's due to play next year in the Met. But she was very supportive of the Opera Kardashian project, obviously, because there was a specific role for a transgender singer, and Dana was always very keen and positive about this has to be sung by a transgender singer because of the story, and she's been very supportive. So that conversation then led on to Dana giving her a call and saying, listen, Lucia, any chance you'd be interested? I know you're this big, you know, opera star, but any chance you'd hop on board? And she immediately said yes. As a matter of fact, we'd love to do this project. And she is also involved in starting in a kind of an entrepreneurial way, creating her own films. So she and her partner Ariana have filmed and edited the film that you'll see on Saturday, So really, we're really lucky to have a really talented crew on board. Ariana herself is, she's a member of the Karlsruhe Staatstheater, their company. So yeah, it's been great, and we're very grateful for the amazing work that they've put into it.
Yeah, Lucia, as you said, with that magnificent baritone voice, she also possesses, I don't know whether it's how she has managed to costume herself so well and make herself up so well and use such a good wig. She is the spitting image of Joe Exotic, it has to be.
Yeah,
a kind of a nightmarish
version.
The internet
is a wonderful thing.
Explain that further, Tom.
Just if you want to buy a Joe Exotic shirt, you just have to do a small bit of Googling and it comes up. But she's nailed the look all right, and it's some look.
Yes, she really has. She's nailed that down. And also that's one thing that also struck me as I was listening to some of those clips in particular, and I did get a little sneak preview, for which thank you very much. It might be called a micro opera in terms of duration, but that's seems like a big full orchestra behind Lucia's voice in that clip that we just heard. How did you create that? Or is that the joys of synthesizer and electronic music now that we can get a full operatic, a full orchestral sound?
Yeah, exactly. It was composed on Sibelius, which anyone who's you know involved in composition will know. That's one of the standard digital composition tools that are used by composers nowadays. And then that was effectively sent effectively arranged by Lucia once the files have been sent over from California, where Dana is, to Germany, where Lucia is living and working. So that was the process of very much just using the amazing tools that are available now.
You mentioned, Tom, the idea of the cliffhanger that's there basically at the end of each episode. And one of the major cliffhangers at one point along the way is Joe Exotic's accusation that Carol Baskin killed her first husband in order to inherit the animal sanctuary. I mean, this is pure operatic plot, in fact, isn't it? And that once she killed him, she fed him to the tigers. I guess you have to put that into the opera. You can't skip past a great plot twist like that.
No, that had to go in. That had to go in. And also there's something just, again, but in her own special way, bizarre about the way that Carol deals with these accusations. She has this funny way of kind of laughing merrily while she discusses the grimmest details and the grimmest accusations that have been thrown at her. So, we tried to capture that. And there's always something nice, I find, about the ridiculousness of an operatic laugh, you know, that kind of ha 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 that you know, you often hear in comic operas. But the way that Ariana has captured it, I think, is fantastic in the second scene of the piece.
Yeah, well, let's listen to Ariana Lucas as Carol Baskin from Exotic v. Baskin, the micro opera.
Some questions folks have been asking. What do I think? What do I think? Oh, the press are so dramatic. Truth is that Don was just erratic. The idea that I would run him through a grinder and feed my husband to the tigers. It makes me my grinder.
That's Ariana Lucas's Carol Baskin in Exotic v. Baskin, the micro opera, with a libretto by Tom Swift, who's speaking to me this evening. She mentions the grinder at the end of it. Let us say no more. Grinder being the American word, of course, what we might call a mincer. And given the story that Joe Exotic believes pertains regarding the death of Carol's husband, I think the visuals for that are best left seen by those who go on Saturday night to the internet to watch it. Tom, this is all part of the Carlo Festival. and their online offers this year. It's slice two. They're giving us a number of slices throughout the month of June, and I think later in the year. That's the plan with the festival this year.
Yeah, I think the idea behind it is just to give people, because I think we're all watching a lot of content, or all been offered a lot of content, full shows, full operas, and maybe our attention span isn't as, you know, long as it should be. So I think the idea here that they've come up with, I think a very smart idea, to do a kind of a live 1 hour show, if you like, with lots of different inserts from people like Kian Kinsella from Lords of Strutt and Crash Ensemble, Louis Lovett, and Felly Speaks, and a host of other people. So I think it's going to be a nice mix of, you know, really, really new and fresh commissioned work.
Yeah, so that's slice two of the Carlow Arts Festival happening on this Saturday evening. There are other slices up as far as number six have been developed at this stage, and then there'll be seven more. In fact, seven plus are in development beyond that. That's Tom Swift speaking to us about Exotic V Baskin, the micro opera. Much more on that Saturday night at Carlow Arts Festival Slice 2. Saturday the 6th of June, 8 p.m. You can visit carlowartsfestival.com for more information and links to streaming. In February 1995, Foo Fighters emerged almost entirely unnoticed onto the stage for the very first time. The band was founded by Nirvana drummer Dave Grohl as a one-man project following the death, at the end of Nirvana, in fact, after the death of Kurt Cobain. I'm joined now by Lauren Murphy to talk about the debut from Foo Fighters. If we start to the background to the band itself, I'm saying they were formed in the wake of a horrible tragedy for Dave Grohl, but in fact, initially, Lauren, it was just Grohl himself.
It was, yeah. As most people would know, obviously Dave Grohl was originally the drummer in Nirvana, the band he joined when he was 22, and which came to a sad ending, as you mentioned, with the death of Kurt Cobain in April 1994. So I guess at a loss for what to do next, Dave Grohl was seeking a creative outlet of some kind. And later that year, I think it was October 94, he booked time in a studio down the street from his house to, you know, casually record these demos that he'd written over the last few years. And he played pretty much every instrument on it. He wrote a lot of the lyrics in the studio and recorded pretty much everything by himself, what would become known as the first Foo Fighters album, in just 6 days. So yeah, it very much was a solo project, and it was never intended as a launchpad for his new rock band or anything like that. He said that he was, you know, very much depressed after the death of his friend and bandmate and the ending of this band that had been so enormously iconic and influential. So he originally only pressed very few copies of the cassette and the vinyl to casually hand out to friends and random strangers that he encountered, and one of them found its way to Capitol Records, basically, and they signed him, and 25 years later, the rest is history, I guess.
Well, let's listen to that debut album. In fact, the opening track from Foo Fighters, the track is called This Is A Call. This Is A Call, the opening track there from Foo Fighters and the debut album of the same name. Lauren Murphy celebrating 25 years of that album, which is making lots of people listening to us this evening, I'm sure, suddenly feel very old, Lauren. But, you know, it is extraordinary when you listen to it there. You got to remember that Grohl was the drummer with Nirvana. So this move out front, even though it was just for friends, initially... How frightening was that for him? Does that come across in any way, do you think, on the album?
Maybe not so much on the album, but yeah, I mean, he was previously known as a drummer in Nirvana, and all the previous bands that he'd been in since he was a teenager, he'd never sung lead vocals in any of those bands. And by all accounts, he was quite insecure about his vocals on the album. I mean, many of the songs, you probably can't tell as a listener, but he's talked about how many of the songs have his vocals double tracked and layered to make them sound beefier and louder, I guess, and stronger. So he was very much in new territory by making this album, which accidentally became his new band. But I don't think you can tell it on the album. Maybe on early video videos of their early performances. There's actually one on YouTube. If you search Foo Fighters Velvet Elvis Seattle on YouTube, there's a 40-minute set where they play most of the album, and I think it was their fourth gig or something like that. It was a very early gig, and you can see there that while he's very convincing as a front man, even then, he's still very much kind of also getting to grips with being out there in front instead of behind the drum kit. So
I'm also wondering,
it was uncharted territory.
Yeah, I'm wondering also in terms of the lyrics, you know, was there depth to them? Was there subtlety in there? Or was it something, you were talking 6 days, did you say? 6 days or 6 weeks?
Yeah,
6 days. You know, if it was thrown together in that fashion, do we see that and hear that in the lyrics or even in the quality of the songwriting?
We do and we don't. I think most of the lyrics were apparently written quite quickly before recording, like you said. So there was no huge depth or thought put into them. But at the same time, he said that whatever he was coming out with in the studio, the gibberish, he's called it, was deliberate because, you know, he couldn't say everything that he wanted to say about Kurt Cobain's death. It's such an enormous thing in his life. So he was kind of writing gibberish in the studio, but he later said that in retrospect, he kind of felt that there was a lot of truth that came through the lyrics on it, maybe on a subconscious level, despite the, you know, the slapdash way they were written. And you can even hear it in song titles. I mean, there's a song called Alone and Easy Target on that album. Or lines like, you know, I don't owe you anything from another song called I'll Stick Around. So there maybe was some subconscious truth going on.
Although the song Big Me, I think, had a more personal aspect to it and that perhaps there's a little bit more depth there, would you argue?
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the exceptions, I reckon. That was a love song written about his then-wife, Jennifer Youngblood. So that was, you would imagine, quite purposeful rather than slapdash. But yeah, that remains one of Foo Fighters' most popular songs, even now.
Well, let's listen to Dave Grohl then in love song mode with the track Big Me. But it's you. Big Me, the title of that track from Foo Fighters and the debut album of the same name. Not sure about the lyric at the end of it there, Lauren Murphy, who's celebrating 25 years of this album with us this evening. It's you I fell into. A little bit clunky, isn't it? But we were just saying here, you know, amongst the team, as we listened to that, that it's a very commercial sound. It's a very radio-friendly sound. It comes in at 2 minutes and 10 seconds. We could play the entire song in the midst of this discussion. Was it a big move away from Nirvana? Was Grohl actually making a specific point about that, do you think? Or was it just he wanted to get out of the depression of the death of Cobain?
I think it was probably a little bit of both, actually. I mean, songs like that definitely showcase the more, you know, melodic, popular sound that Foo Fighters now are known for and have become known for, as does the opening track, This Is a Call. But you could never imagine several other songs on a Nirvana album either, you know. But then again, there's definitely some clear parallels with Nirvana on other songs, especially their album Nevermind, that song Alone and Easy Target that I mentioned earlier. His vocals even sound slightly Cobain-esque, whether that was deliberate or not. But yeah, it's a bit of both. I think it's an album that doffs its cap to his punk influences and his time in Nirvana, but it's also very much forging a new path for himself and saying, this is what I'm doing now. It's a bit more commercial.
And do we still think of Foo Fighters as Grohl, the solo artist, or really has it grown into the band now? Because how long after the debut album did he bring others in?
Pretty soon afterwards. The label obviously wanted him to tour the album live because it was such a success. So he recruited other musicians to play the songs live, which is basically how Foo Fighters that we know today were formed. And some of them were drawn from his time in Nirvana. Pat Smear, the guitarist, had been a touring guitarist with Nirvana for years. But others, the bassist Nate Mendel and the then drummer, the original drummer, William Goldsmith, were recruited from a band called Sunny Day Real Estate. So William Goldsmith would later be replaced by Taylor Hawkins. But yeah, they were brought together to play the album live, essentially. And most of them have stayed with Grohl until now.
Yeah, I'm always dubious when you know, people say, oh, I didn't mean it to be anything other than just an album for a few pals. It was just a side project. I didn't really think it had become anything. I mean, it's become hugely, Foo Fighters has and have become hugely successful. Do you believe Grohl when he says he didn't expect that kind of success?
I kind of do and I don't. I mean, like, what musician doesn't put out music without wanting it to be hugely successful, you know? But at the same time, I understand why he wanted a creative outlet. But, you know, Foo Fighters are now one of the biggest rock bands on the planet. So he must have known that there was something in that album that would resonate with huge audiences.
And is the album, did you enjoy revisiting it 25 years on? Was it worth the listen back?
I actually really did because, you know, I'd consider myself a casual Foo Fighters fan. It's an album I haven't really gone back to much. But listening to it from start to finish for a good few times over the last few weeks and for the first time in a good few years, I realised what a great album it really was. And knowing that Grohl was the sole architect of it too, it's a huge accomplishment. And it's aged really well too. It doesn't sound particularly dated or cheesy. It certainly doesn't sound 25 years
I'm going old. I'm going to finish up, Lauren, by listening to Alone and Easy Target. You'd say this is more, I suppose, a nod towards Cobain and Nirvana, is it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's one of the harder songs in the album, I reckon.
All right, that's it. Lauren Murphy there speaking to us about Foo Fighters, the debut album, 25 years old this year. And let's listen to Alone and Easy Target. Excerpt there from The Seven Samurai Suite, composed by Fumio Hayasaka and taken from the seminal 1954 movie Seven Samurai. Directed by Akira Kurosawa, the movie went on to influence scores of directors across the world and was most famously remade in the United States by director John Burgess as The Magnificent Seven. Seven Samurai is the best known of Kurosawa's movies, but it's far from the only film he made to have broken artistic ground. And in the latest of our series, Where Do I Begin With?, Reinoshi Greer has been taking a look at the great Japanese director's work and has chosen three movies to open that work up to us. Reinoshi, it's a career in terms of Kurosawa that spanned 57 years. Movie fans will regularly name check Seven Samurai as being hugely important to him. But that's not his only movie. And Samurai is not, it's not the only movie in which samurais will feature.
Exactly, yeah. And I think, you know, where to begin with a director as legendary and influential as him, you know, I think a lot of people kind of consider him to be probably one of the single greatest influences on modern cinema. And he's made melodramas to social thrillers to Shakespeare adaptations to Dostoevsky. But I think for me, my way into them was initially through samurai films, because when I was a kid, I was obsessed with Japanese culture and mostly through samurais because they were always just really cool. Yeah. And the genre of the jidaigeki, which is a particular genre of Japanese film, of a period drama, sort of became very popularized by Akira Kurosawa and sort of introduced them onto the world as well.
The samurai culture, it's okay being opened up to it through the films of Kurosawa. He was actually opened up to the samurai culture by his family. Was it his father?
Yeah, his father, Izamu, was from a member of a samurai family from the Akita prefecture. So he came from a very long line of samurai families, but he lived a fairly regular life just in a district of Tokyo with his mother and his siblings. But his early life kind of saw a lot of hardship because he grew up during the Great Kanto Earthquake of 1923, and he began to make films right in the middle of World War II. And during the Kanto Earthquake of 1923, it was his brother who took him out to view the devastation. And when he saw the dead bodies and corpses floating down the Sumida River, he wanted to look away, but his brother made him confront the brutality of what he saw, so that he had to look at them directly and confront his fears by looking at them directly. And some commentators have suggested that that was the single most influential moment in his early life that would make him confront unpleasant truths about the world later on in his own work.
Now, we'll talk about Seven Samurai, that film specifically, a little bit later. But the first movie that you've chosen, the one you suggest we start with if we want to find out a little bit more about Kurosawa, is Rashomon from 1950. We're in samurai land again here, I think, Reinach, but this really was the first of his films to get him noticed internationally, gain him respect and recognition.
Exactly. And it wasn't just the first film that got him in recognised internationally. It was the first film that introduced an entire world to Japanese cinema. It was the most popular Japanese movie of that time, and it won the Venice Film Festival in 1951. It got an Academy Honorary Award at the 24th Academy Awards. And it's generally considered one of the best films of all time because of its narrative structure. And it's, you know, you'll often hear in crime genre and thrillers the idea of the Rashomon effect, of various characters reliving a crime by retelling the same events but told from a very different point of view. And the whole nature of it is about memory being unreliable and people embellishing moments to be able to forward their own self-interest. And Rashomon tells the story of a crime has happened, a dead samurai has been found in the woods, and they've arrested a bandit. But as they interview each member who's involved, the bandit, the wife, and then the ghost of the dead man through a medium, we begin to unravel that there's not such an easy set story to this murder mystery.
And of course, you talk about the Rashomon effect, and when you say different perspectives, now in 2020, we might go, well, sure, so what? Yeah, we often get that. But in 1950, how groundbreaking was it?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, you know, in ways you can kind of compare a lot of it to Agatha Christie style, kind of a very strong crime trope that, you know, one person is always going to tell a very different story to someone else involved in the crime. But it's definitely been a more popularized structure that's then worked its way and permeated its way into crime drama and crime fiction. But it's also the moral tale at the center of it, the fact that, you know, truth and memory are not as reliable as they seem, and that self-interest is always going to reflect your memory and your retelling of a certain event.
What about Seven Samurai? So Rashomon is the first movie you would suggest that we take a look at to open up this Kurosawa world to ourselves. Seven Samurai then, 4 years later, 1954. Remade as The Magnificent Seven. How much of a straightforward, you know, almost retelling of the same story is The Magnificent Seven? I'm asking you to tell us basically what the story is in the midst of that.
Oh, God, it's actually been such a long time since I've seen The Magnificent Seven. And I've probably watched Seven Samurai about 50 million times as well. And actually, interestingly enough, Pixar's A Bug's Life is also riffing off the same central story as Seven Samurai as well. And, you know, I think adaptation seems to be quite a common theme in Kurosawa's work as well. And he himself has adapted Shakespeare plays like King Lear and Macbeth, but he's chosen his own kind of retelling of them as well. But for Magnificent Seven, it's not too straight an adaptation. But I think what makes Seven Samurai so prolific is everything down to how it defined the action genre with its visceral style, the movement within the frame, the kineticism. Yeah. But it also kind of it's the visual language that you hardly ever need to be reading the subtitles to really understand the emotion and the feeling of what's going on. There's always something like wind or rain or fire going on in the background. There's always a number of different people within one static frame to convey a certain emotion. And you just get this whole sense of how movement and the elements within a frame determine your emotional response to a film and increase your engagement with everything, not just the story itself. And I think that's what makes it so special and a million times better than Magnificent Seven, although that is still a really, really enjoyable movie.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, the Western genre was well established in Hollywood before 1950, but did Seven Samurai, did it change the way Westerns were made? Did it push them off in a new direction?
It's kind of weird because at the same time, we are getting all these classic American Westerns that were influencing Japanese filmmakers, and then they were influencing Kurosawa to make films like Yojimbo, which then influenced Sergio Leone to make Fistful of Dollars. And yeah. Yojimbo is a story of a Ronin caught between two warring gangs in a small town. And that's exactly the storyline of Fistful of Dollars. But it's also got the long explored parallels of, honor and lone mercenaries, lawless towns. It's sort of the two genres have kind of developed throughout the years in parallel to each other and riffed off each other, stole from each other and inspired each other as well.
Well, I guess in some ways you are dealing with, you know, epic, almost archetypal characters here behaving in an archetype, a typical fashion in the things that they do. They behave to type rather than some very strong psychological motivation other than loyalty to each other for a samurai and
exactly.
Indeed for the Magnificent Seven. As well, is it really about visual language here rather than about character development or psychology?
It's definitely both for me, because I think what makes Seven Samurai so riveting, and it's nearly 4 hours long, so but it keeps you hooked scene after scene, and you never disengage from the whole thing because the characters are so engaging and they go through amazing and surprising arcs of every single one of the farmers who's involved, every single one of the samurai. But at the very heart of it, there's a really provocative message, which I think, you know, watching it again at the weekend, it kind of, it's really evocative to watch it now, where you see a system of people working together from different worlds, strengths, weaknesses, experiences to fight a common enemy. And, you know, I think when the world seems to be kind of falling apart, the sort of collective struggle is worth fighting for. As one of the main characters says, by protecting others, you save yourself. And, it never ceases to kind of to rile me every time I watch it. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and a great movie will have that quality, that when there is a very difficult contemporary situation, a classic will speak to it in ways that you may not have noticed before, but that's what makes the movie classic. Your final selection then, Reinach, for us in terms of Kurosawa, is not just your favourite Kurosawa movie, but I think your favourite movie of all time, Ran.
Absolutely. And I mean, like, when you get asked that question, you kind of feel, you try to narrow it down, but it's always the one that sticks at the corner of my mind completely. So it's a 1985 epic tragedy. It's in, well, the other films are made in beautiful black and white. This is made in stunning technicolor, just absolutely vivid colors. And it's a plot that derives loosely enough from Shakespeare's King Lear. And it's about a warlord who decides to abdicate as ruler and separate his kingdom to his three sons. So what follows is the fullest expression of what a war movie is in terms of its tragedy, with scenes of nightmarish visions of hellish battle scenes, and every single frame that you see is as vivid as a painting, and the entire chaos, which is what Ran means, the whole madness of war, the greed and the violence. There's something that just works together with every single element of colour, with every single sun that is colour-coded and every single movement and character. And it also has one of the best female villains of all time, the vengeful kimono-clad Lady Kaida.
And would you term, would you class Ran as a samurai movie as well?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, when asked to kind of narrow down his movies, I think they're always at the top of the list for me. But yeah I think that this is, I suppose, less than, if Seven Samurai is an action film and Rashomon is a crime story, this would be a war film. And it's the scale at which all of those war scenes are shot that are just so magnificent to take in. So it's a samurai war movie.
And finally then, Reinach, he not only did he influence a generation of directors and American movie makers, he went on to work with the likes of Spielberg and Scorsese.
Exactly, yeah. As many filmmakers have referenced him as big influences on them, Spielberg began to fund his later work. And one of the films that he made was a spectacular literal collection of dreams called Dreams, in which he takes dreams that he's had over the course of his life. And one of them is a dream that he had with Vincent van Gogh, and that's played by Martin Scorsese.
Well, that's Reinach Nigrir there speaking to us about the great Japanese director Akira Kurosawa and the movies that Reinach selected for us to get started with when it comes to Kurosawa, or Rashomon, The Seven Samurai and Ran. And just coming up to 9 minutes to 8 o'clock on Tuesday night's Arena. Recent events mean we're looking at our public spaces with renewed interest, something of a different eye perhaps. Lockdown has made us take closer note of the places we share with one another, places we once could take for granted. The St Nicholas Quarter is an historic part of Dundalk town, a pedestrianised meeting place framed by two churches. And as of a few days ago, it now offers one more reason for passers-by to pause and take stock. A new public sculpture of two abstract swans in bronze called Heart Space. The artist is Breda Marin, and she joins me on the line now from Drogheda. The swans, I saw a picture of the new sculpture today, Breda. The swans, they're turned in, they're facing each other in close proximity, but not quite touching. You know, you couldn't make it up that you obviously didn't know this when you started working on the piece in 2018. You didn't know we were going to be in this situation right now.
I know, it's unbelievable, the time. It was that idea all along, was that the two swans were holding space for each other. And it was linking back to Anamkara, which is that belief in the soul friend, the person who accepts you as you are and sees you and reflects back the best light of yourself. So from the beginning, it was very much the space between was as important as the pieces themselves, but for a totally different reason than what we now find ourselves in. So, yeah, it's been unbelievable the way things have moved.
Yeah, because we've quite often seen the necks of the swans, I suppose, with that shape that they can come together in that beautiful coupledom to give us the shape of a heart. But yours is about the space as much as it is about the heart itself, just quite extraordinary. We have golden creatures on the inside and green on the outside. Was there some specific reasons for those particular colours, Breda?
Yeah, there was, because where the sculpture is based, there's St Nicholas's Roman Catholic Church, and just on the other side then is St Nicholas Church of Ireland, which has a beautiful green steeple. So it was about finding the sculpture, to find the space for itself inside that area. And the gold in the inner part was about that heart of gold. And I'm lucky enough to know a lot of people in Dundalk, and I count some of them as just being the best friends ever, or the people you could really rely on and have a heart of gold. So it's that idea of bringing a piece of sculpture that captures the community and they're able to connect to. And the whole idea at the beginning of the whole project, the regeneration of Dundalk, was to... along with a lot of towns in Ireland, the centre of the town has kind of nearly evaporated and the heart has gone out of the community, and a lot of town centres are quite quiet, and the energy kind of just isn't there. So the focus of this project was to bring the heart of the community back into the centre and to give people places where there's areas to sit and there's something there to actually connect with people, and it's not just about the consumer end of things. So it was getting people to enjoy spending time together.
this is a 2 meter tall. These are big swans. I don't think you'd want to meet them coming down the canal bank at any point along the way. What was the idea in that scale? What does it give us, Breda?
Well, it was the fact that there are two quite large architectural pieces like the church and the chapel either side, and this is kind of the midpoint. It was about, it actually looks quite small when it has that kind of landscape or architecture behind it, but it was bringing it down to a more intimate human level. So it's literally when you stand beside it, it's only a foot higher than yourself, but it's that feeling of connection that you're nearly at the same level as the sculpture, yet they're there, there's a sense of protection and holding space for the person.
Yeah, and it's also, I should point out that it's depending on where you're standing, I guess, whether you see the heart shape or whether you see different aspects of that heart shape, or maybe a slightly broken heart, depending on what part of the square you're standing in.
Well, it was that kind of sense that they were really having a dance with each other and the movement and the flow. And it, as you move, and just because where the sculpture is, there's about three different streets that lead onto that area. So you're coming at it from different angles and it nearly seems like they move in motion with each other. But when you get up close, then you can see they've actually got separate identities and each one allows space for the other to be.
Good advice for anybody who's who wants to make some sort of a relationship with another person or swan. Dundalk, of course, and indeed the St. Nicholas Quarter, close links with Robbie Burns, the National Poet of Scotland. That was part of, I think that kind of sent you off in the direction that you ended up in. Maybe you went somewhere you weren't expecting to go.
Yeah, from the beginning, because of the whole transformation and rejuvenation of the area, the swan came through as a natural symbol. But when I looked into Robert Burns and his sister Agnes is buried in the graveyard at the St. Nicholas Church of Ireland, and nearby is Robbie Burns' cottage and Stephen's Park, it was that idea that, well, if this is the Scottish link for the poet, what about the ancient Irish and the links to the Celtic bards and the poets? And then I came across the vision or the story of where they used to wrap themselves in a cloak with songbird feathers and swan feathers, and it was that idea of instilling the inspiration of transformation that birds are associated with, especially the swan, to bring them to another level of consciousness and awareness and to tap into inspiration when they were looking for words for their poetry and for guidance. So it was that idea of bringing that into it as well and wrapping the swans in this like protective green coat and holding that golden space inside.
Yeah, and the swan, of course, quite a mythical creature. I suppose it carries some of those aspects with us as well in your thinking.
Yeah, and it's just loud. It's so rich in heritage and mythology, and it's kind of linking the past with where we are now and the future moving forward and the rejuvenation of that project. It's just trying to combine all of those together through the imagery of the sculpture.
What about, one of the great moments, I guess, for any artist in when you've got a piece of public art like this is the opening, the unveiling of the statue. How did that work? How did that work? Given we're in these socially distanced times.
Yeah, well, I suppose there hasn't been any official unveiling, but it was more about the last week was really installing the sculpture. So it's kind of each day had another little bit finished off. So now at the minute it's pretty much finished, and it's not like a big wow and every gathered round and a sheet taken off the top is all unveiled. It's kind of very much a bit by bit and the practical end of things. So, yeah, so people got to see as they're walking past, they got to see it being installed and all that end of things. And I suppose there's been a lot of positive feedback through social media because a lot of people aren't able to go into the town. So thanks to social media, people who are nearby have seen that it is there and they're looking forward to or able to drive by then during the weekend or in times ahead.
Yeah. Do you think public art in particular has a role maybe now that has been amplified by our current situation, Breda?
Well, for this piece in particular, because it's that idea of bringing the community together, having a space that is a nice experience to sit in and to add something to the area and to the real heart of the town, that, yeah, I think it does. It has a way, if it can connect to the people and people understand and feel a connection to it and a sense of peace or calmness when they're beside it, or it lifts the area a little bit as well. It adds pride to the area. So I feel, yeah, there's a lot of things can be done with art to bring the sense of community and connection back.
Well, lovely to speak with you this evening, Breda, and I look forward to getting to a point when I am allowed to travel to Dundalk and see the piece in reality rather than look at a picture of it, because it does look quite magnificent in its setting. That's Breda Maron speaking to us about Heart Space, her sculpture in St. Nicholas Quarter in Dundalk, and you can find out more details on Breda's own website, breedamarin.com. All right, that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.